Good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and this morning we kick off with a conversation with Josh Hobson. He initiated last year's, the first March for Science here in Park City, and he's joining us this morning to give us a preview of this year's March on April 14th.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm John Wells. And then we're going to be speaking with Carl Hoffman, who writes The Last Wild Men of Borneo, a true story of death and treasure. Hoffman explores questions about our relationship with tribal peoples and their vanishing cultures as he recreates the fascinating stories of two men, a Swiss environmental warrior, Bruno Manser, and an American art dealer, Michael Palmieri, who sought escape and found personal fulfillment in the wilds of Borneo.
After we talk to him, I just know it, John. You're going to escape into the wilds, never to be seen again. There's an allure about that.
The wilds of Kimball Junction.
Of historic New Park.
Yes.
And finally, we'll speak with Sang-hee Lee. She is Korea's first paleoanthropologist and a professor at the University of California who investigates our evolving species in a new book called Close Encounters with Humankind. Have you ever wondered what we truly have in common with the Neanderthals? Or what fossilized teeth can tell us about the life expectancy of our ancient ancestors? Or how farming played a problematic role in the history of human evolution. There we go. And all these questions and more, really interesting. So stay with us for that conversation. It's Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
At All Seasons Resort Lodging, we get why you love Park City. It's our home, and it's why we support local radio with KPCW. Since 1999, our passion is helping second homeowners rent and care for their property with nightly rental management and HOA services. More information about our property management services at allseasonsresortlodging.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Well, Josh Hobson is joining us now in the studio. He's looking ahead to April 14th and the March for Science. He organized last year's march, and he rounded up a bunch of great scientists to talk to the audience about the importance of embracing science. Josh, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. So it starts Saturday morning, brew pub parking lot, again, it's at 11 o'clock?
Correct, 11 o'clock.
And so is it going to be like last year where you had an event up there, you had the march, and then you had some speakers in Jim Santee Auditorium?
Essentially, yes. The biggest logistic difference for that between last year and this year is we're not going to circle back up to the brew pub lot. We will just go, we'll have our rally at the brew pub lot first and then march essentially straight to the library and then have our speaker presentations start shortly thereafter.
Okay. So what was it about it, the march? It's a national march, and each city can decide to do their own rendition of it. And what really caught your attention about doing it, and what was the catalyst for you?
It really started from when I was walking home from the Women's March last year, thinking, hey, this was great. There's so much energy. There's so much passion for this. What else can we do? What else is big? And a few days later, I had heard that there was a scientist march on Washington. And so connected with those folks and found out that there were already satellite marches planned throughout the country. So thought, well, I'll do one here because this community, especially in this state, policy-wise, I believe we take science a little bit more seriously than some of our peers.
And I was in the Women's March last year and also the Science March, and there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm in both. And you did a great job with the Science March, and It's so exciting to think that there are so many people around the country. When you think about Boston's upcoming march, New York, D.C., Los Angeles, all these smaller communities like Park City, it's just very exciting. And I was trying to think if there was ever precedence for that type of thing in the science community before. And I think that during the Reagan presidency, and he was in term for, he was in for 8 years, there were a couple of science marches for, like, doctors against nuclear war, mm-hmm. or they had some scientists that were walking, but they weren't very well organized, and they didn't take off with the enthusiasm that this one has.
Right.
What is the goal of this year's march?
Well, there are kind of two parallel issues going on, because we do primarily want to be a celebration of science in our lives, in our policy, in our communities. But some of it is still a protest against really kind of the push to bring back coal and to rescind a lot of the regulatory measures that made our air and water clean for the last couple of decades, and the appointment of agency administrators who have strong ties in the industries that they're supposed to be protecting our environment against. So, you know, none of that has changed. In fact, looking at what Scott Pruitt has done in the last year, I'm angrier now than I was last year. But we also very much want this to be a positive thing and not just a, oh, we're angry protest. Because we're angry about this because there's good science that is being ignored on especially at the federal level, but at our state level too. And part of our target audience for this are lawmakers, our policymakers, to show, hey, we're paying attention to this and this is significant to us. And, you know, perhaps next time when the election comes around in November, we'll say, hey, you were going to ban our plastic bag ban. We're not going to vote for you. Now, of course, that wasn't any of our local state electeds, and thank you all for that. But
they did a great job of supporting our position, didn't they?
Yes, mm-hmm. And really, thank you, Tim Quinn, for that. I really do appreciate that. But still, there are so many other areas that need to be addressed. The state legislature is going to spend $2 million to sue the state of California for harming our coal industry. That is an obnoxious waste of money to me. And why are we even bothering?
Are you referencing in that the decision in Oakland to not allow a distribution channel for coal? Okay.
Right.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, no, it's... Oh, sure. I'll send you the article on that. It's both fascinating and really kind of aggravating. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, exactly. What's interesting, Lynn, is one of the goals, I believe, last year isn't the same this year, and that's to get political leaders and policymakers to enact evidence-based policies in our public interest. And it's a brave new world, and these kids came out of nowhere on gun control, and nobody saw them coming. They just mm-hmm. got together. Nickelodeon did not broadcast for 17 minutes yesterday. Mm-hmm. There's a way to do this that maybe we haven't even thought of yet, because these kids surprised us, and I'm wondering, what's the best way to do it? What's the best way to get our goals accomplished?
That's a really good question, and one that we're actually trying to figure out to some extent is a march down Main Street the most productive use of our time? You can argue, perhaps not, but at the same time, to get attention to some of these issues, to make people aware that, you know, again, that we're paying attention to these, and we're...
Well, I'm not saying we don't march. I love to march.
We
got to have the march.
Yeah.
Well, there's an upside, I think, to some of these egregious affronts or compromises to things that are important to us, like science. And that is that it creates protest. And then, as you say, the efficient way to protest. You know, the march might be also coupled with, I love what the kids did this in support of DACA, the Youth City Council in Park City, was to all get together and have a letter writing campaign one night. Like, what a great thing. Or a calling campaign that you all get together and you make it a social event, but everyone's on their phone calling our elected officials. You know, that could be, you know, giving direction about how to make calls, or let's all do it right now.
Absolutely. And before the science presentations at the Santee begin, in the community room, we're going to have what we're calling a microscience fair. But one of the tables that we're going to have there is voter registration, mm-hmm. because Great. That is one of the things that we want to see with this is, hey, if you agree with us and you live here and you're not registered to vote, let's correct that.
Yeah. That's great. So I know that you're a month out about. Mm-hmm. It's March 15th, and the march is taking place April 14th. So who do you have booked in terms of confirmations for speakers?
Well, we are going to bring Dr. Brian Mensch back, one of our speakers from last year, who is the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, and was just a fantastic speaker. He's going to give us some updates on both his research and what's been going on at the state level. Then we have Dr. Robert Salia, who from the American MedChem, and basically his job for the last several decades is creating medicines for rare and undiagnosed diseases, and he's just a fascinating person. And then I'm not saying this is the full list, but then also Anu Posse Roust, this is a very interesting thing, and really, I just came across this a couple of days ago, so I haven't done the full depth research, but she works for Space Nation, which is a space media company that's developed an app to essentially to develop astronaut skills. And then you can compete with other app users to get some physical training with actual astronauts, and it just sounds fascinating. And you know, the little kid in me just wants to hear everything about that.
Oh, that's great, John. You'll be into that too.
Of course.
Is she local?
No, she's not.
Okay. But. All right. Well, just about a minute left. Anything else that we need to run through in terms of schedule? So people come, they go up to the brew pub parking lot. Right. It starts promptly at 11.
Exactly. So we will start at 11. We'll have a small number of speakers at a rally at the brew pub lot, probably about 15 to 20 minutes, and then we will start marching to the library. The speaker presentations will start roughly 12:15, just to make sure everyone has enough time to make it from the top of Main Street to the library. And again, we will have some tables set up in the community room with local nonprofits kind of showing the science of what they do, and then have our speaker presentations, which were really just, to me, that was my favorite part of it last year was, hey, we demonstrated, we marched, and now let's learn something, because science is cool. And, you know, like that kind of public access to science and their latest research, it's fantastic to me.
Well, Lynn Ware Peake's going to need some extra time to get to Santee, because she stops and talks to everybody, and then she gets to get a little coffee and stuff. But I tell you, I was with you.
That's the beauty of a march.
I was with you last year, and we were walking around a lot before the whole thing started, and then, of course, we marched together, and you were talking to everyone. I got such a kick out of it. I really did. She's like a little mare, you know?
You're just as social as I am. It's a beautiful thing, though. And talking about science.
Science is a beautiful thing.
Well, Josh Hobson, thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming in. And there is a Facebook page.
Right. Just search for March for Science Park City, and you will find it.
Okay, wonderful.
Science, not silence.
Yeah, exactly.
The oceans are rising, and so are we.
I like that. We need T-shirts.
We're going to get some T-shirts. We'll get some T-shirts.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate
it. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you. Stay with us. We'll be back for a fascinating story. Carl Hoffman joins us. He writes a book about the last wild men of Borneo, a true story of death and treasure. You won't want to miss this one. It's Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these words.
Hi, I'm Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts a variety of events throughout the winter season, including our new Seven Summits Challenge, weekly live music, Spring Groove, concerts, and more. More information about events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek, here with John Wells.
Yeah, and we were just speaking with Josh Hobson. And remember, the March for Science is April 14th. Put that in your calendar. We will all march together for science. Now our next guest, award-winning author Carl Hoffman. He wrote New York Times bestseller Savage Harvest, A Tale of Cannibals, Colonialism. He is a former contributor, contributing editor to the National Geographic Traveler and Wired magazines. He's traveled on assignment to 80 countries. In his quest for adventure, he finds himself in Borneo, immersed in the story of two men and their hunt for treasure. He brings us a true story of the high-stakes world of the international art trade in on one of the last places on the globe. His book is titled The Last Wild Men of Borneo, A True Story of Death and Treasure. Carl Hoffman, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Yeah, very, very nice to have you on the program. Maybe you can take a minute and tell us about your two characters, because they could not be more different. They're very different. Tell us about them.
Well, that's true on the surface anyway. There are two characters. One is a Swiss man named Bruno Mansur, who went into the sort of the highest, deepest reaches of the mountains of Borneo in the Malaysian part called Sarawak in search of the last nomadic hunter-gatherers known as the Pinon, and stayed with them for 6 years and became so Pinon that the Pinon themselves called him Pinon Man. And the other character is named Michael Palmieri, and he is an American from Southern California, and he, too, lit out for Asia and ended up living in Bali, but going into Borneo, both the Malaysian Sarawak side and the Indonesian Kalimantan side, over and over again over a period of 40 years, into up the rivers and into the villages, in search of the art of the Dayaks, the indigenous people there. And so on the surface, you know, these two men, one just sort of wants to live in absolute nature with the Pinon and not have any contacts with the outside world, and the other going in and out, collecting their art. But there are similarities as well, and of course their paths crossed.
Yes, so Bruno, idealistic, kind of do the right thing against Western consumerism. Michael, opportunistic, to use your word, a buccaneer of sorts, a modern-day buccaneer. And their lives intersected at some point, right before Bruno disappeared. And that's where you come in, is that correct?
Well, yes. I mean, the genesis of the book goes back to my own, you know, I grew up obsessed with adventure stories and tales of exploration, and then that led into indigenous people. And in 2012, I actually lived in a very remote part of New Guinea while I was researching my book about the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller. And it was when I was living in that village of among the Asmat people that I sort of, my whole vision of how we view indigenous people kind of changed. I mean, I suddenly saw them. I suddenly saw that many Westerners, and myself included, you know, kind of exoticize and fetishize indigenous people, and that the realities of their lives were more complex and nuanced, and that we kind of project onto them our own fantasies and dreams and anxieties. And I wanted to explore that, and I had all long known about the story of Bruno, and been thinking about it and pondering this idea that Bruno was sort of an avatar for exploring those ideas of mine. And then I just happened to meet Michael sort of by serendipity, and Michael told me this wild tale, and then he told me how their paths had crossed, and that's when I knew that, that there was a story here.
So as John says, both men went to Borneo for very different reasons. Can you talk a little bit more about Michael? He's an art trader, art collector of sorts, and his appeal, or it's indigenous art that he is specifically interested in. Is that right?
That's correct. And in particular, the art of the indigenous people of Borneo, who are known collectively by the name of Dayaks. I mean, they're really a collection of, you know, hundreds of different of people with slightly different languages and cultural traditions, but sort of under that umbrella. And, you know, the time that Bruno and Michael went in, you know, in the 70s and the 80s was a time of great change in Borneo, you know, very people who live fairly remote lives and very traditional lives, suddenly, you know, the outside world was coming in at a quickening pace, and logging and mineral extraction and missionaries all going in. So as those cultures began to change, Michael was going in and buying and trading for their art, and that art suddenly became very, very valuable. And today, many of the things that Michael collected, you know, are in museums around the world.
Right. And two Michaels, Michael Rockefeller, Michael Palmieri. You write about Michael Rockefeller and his disappearance in Savage Harvest. Is that right?
That's correct.
And both of them are on this quest for indigenous art. And I believe Michael Rockefeller had retrieved and brought back to, and they're on display in museums of modern art, indigenous art in New York, I believe. Is that right?
Well, Michael collected and was bought about 500 objects before he vanished. Those objects were later brought to the U.S. after his death, and many of them are in the Michael C. Rockefeller Room at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
Yeah. Both books, you know, fascinating. Go ahead.
I think this book is really about, you know, a hunger sort of for a certain treasure, a perceived treasure of indigenous people, and that Michael and Bruno, as different as they seemed, really were after the same thing, mm-hmm. and that Michael was really after the sort of physical expression of the thing that Bruno was trying to get, and which is something that Westerners, I think, have long sought, which is, and especially increasingly so, I think now, this idea that indigenous people have a connection to the land and the environment and nature that we've sort of lost, and a connection to this spiritual world that we hunger for.
You know, I find the whole thing amazing. I mean, to many people, a big lifestyle change is turning off their cell phone for an hour. And that's it. Here's Bruno. He walks into the jungle. I don't believe has any contacts with the Penin, and he just joins them, and they take him in, and it's just a completely different way of life. Can you describe that way of life?
Yes, the Penin were pure hunter-gathering nomads, which means they lived in small bands deep in the forest. They had no villages per se. They would, they can in 30 minutes they can whack a few trees down and create a house, a shelter, and they would stay in those shelters for several weeks or several months, depending on their, depending on their food sources. And they would just hunt mostly wild boar was their preferred food, and various fruit trees and sago. The starch of the sago palm, and they lived. The tribes of the Dayaks of Borneo were warriors and headhunters, and had incredible art and tattooed their bodies. And the Pinon were very different. They looked similar, but they had little adornment, and they were completely nonviolent. They didn't engage in any warfare. They were very shy. And it was, and you know, they shared everything that they had. And it was that sort of sense of sharing and that shyness, I think, and that pure living that Bruno was so attracted to.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Carl Hoffman, who's written a fascinating book, The Last Wild Men of Borneo, a true story of death and treasure. In the year 2000, Bruno disappeared. He vanished. What do you think happened to him?
Well, Bruno, you know, went into the Pinon, and he had no aspirations for any fame or fortune or changing the world in any way. You know, he just wanted to kind of escape in a way. But about a year after his sojourn, logging accelerated in Malaysia, and to such a degree that it came into the traditional lands of the Pinon. And you know, their trees were just, their whole world was being destroyed. And so Bruno ended up kind of organizing and leading the Pinon in this series of blockades of logging roads that brought this billion-dollar industry to a halt and angered the government. And he became a wanted man, and he was arrested twice and escaped twice under gunfire. And that pressure mounted and mounted until he escaped from Borneo after 6 years in 1990. But then he went back to Switzerland to sort of lead this movement. But he kept going in and out of Borneo, in and out, sneaking in, which is a very dangerous thing. And all of his efforts to stop the logging, even though he became quite famous around the world, amounted to very little. I mean, yeah. The forest was cut down at the same pace as it always was. And he became despondent, and friends were worried about him. And in 2000, he said he was going back into Sarawak, into Borneo. And by that time, most of the forest was gone, and people were worried about him. I mean, his girlfriend even refused to drive him to the airport. He said he didn't know when he'd be back, and he went in and vanished. Mm. And it's a sad and tragic tale. I won't tell you what I think happened to him here. I mean, got to save something for the book, but it's a sad story.
Yeah. On the cover of your book is a photo of Bruno, and he's crouching, squatting on a rock in the, you know, midstream. He's holding a spear. He's got his, he's dressed with, what do you call that? A loincloth, for lack of a better word. And what the thing I found amazing, it could just be my eyesight, but it was hard to distinguish him from the Pinon when you had photos, a group photos. The only thing that really distinguished is he wore eyeglasses, which I thought was really fascinating. As a Swiss, a Swiss man, he looked very indigenous. I guess it's, you know, the loincloth does that to you.
Well, it's not just him. He's in a loincloth. He's otherwise naked. He's squatting on that rock with, it looks like a spear, but it's actually a blowpipe.
Oh.
He's got a quiver of poison arrows hanging from the loincloth. I mean, Bruno became more Pinon than the Pinon. I mean, at the time, you know, in the 80s, when he first went in, you know, the Pinon were beginning to, the outside world was coming in, and they often dressed in T-shirts and gym shorts and wore watches, even though those watches often didn't work, and cut their hair. And Bruno went the opposite way. He wanted to wear a loincloth, and he wanted to hunt with a blowpipe, and he grew his hair in this sort of almost like a mullet, which was the traditional Pinon cut. Mm-hmm. And that really represents both all the tropes that he fell into himself, even though he didn't intend to, and the tension really between, you know, his aspirations and reality, and even the reality that the Pinon themselves were facing. I mean, you know, lots of Pinons wanted to settle and to wanted things, and just like everybody wants things.
Right. You know, fascinating about books like yours are the story within the story. I mean, the story's about Michael, it's about Bruno, but in a lot of ways, it's also about you and your having traveled to 80 countries on assignment and your fascination with these stories and to a certain degree, like you say, your sense of adventure. And I found this interesting thing about you, CNN, that where you take on this endeavor to go on the world's scariest roads and airlines traveling as locals do, which, wow, I've been on a few bus rides in my life and in countries where, you know, you never even hear of the times the bus goes careening off the side of the cliff because it's a very narrow road with no protection. What, you know, was there anything that you learned about yourself, or was it just a continuation of your interest?
Well, I think I've been on a path to deeper understanding, and you know, the Afghan journey that you're referring to took place while I was doing my book called The Lunatic Express, and that was not really so much of just an attempt to be have a wild adventure, so much as to understand the world and understand you know, who these people, how the world, you know, I had been, you know, reporting and writing from lots of places all over the world, and I'd seen these you know, buses, boats, trucks full of, you know, packed with people on the move, and I wondered, you know, who those people were and why they were going and where they were going, and I wanted to understand that, and so I sort of took this journey around the world, ultimately 50,000 miles. And then, you know, one thing kind of leads to another. I mean, that you know, you go on these things, you have these questions, and you go on these quests to sort of answer them, and that always just produces more questions. And, you know, that led me to always want to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And so then I, you know, the Michael Rockefeller story came along, and, you know, ostensibly that's a story about, you know, what happened to Michael, but it's really, it ends up being a story much more about these people, the people who killed him and what was happening to them in the 1960s and, you know, this end of colonialism and this forced sort of change to their lives and living with them, which then made me ask more questions and want to go deeper. And I found that Bruno and Michael were vehicles to ask that. And it's really, they're all those questions in a lot of ways are asking about what, you know, our own kind of relationships to the rest of the world are.
I'm curious if the Penan have seen the book or what their reaction might be to the book.
That's a good question. I mean, it just came out last week, so I think not yet. I think they would appreciate it. I mean, you know, I don't know that any will actually read it, but, you know, the Penan loved Bruno, and they looked at him as a brother, and as a hero, and they still do, largely, even though he's been gone a long time. So, you know, that said, I think that that Bruno, you know, the story of Bruno and the Penan and the logging gets super complicated. So, you know, I think that the Penan, you know, they appreciate Bruno.
Sure, yeah. Carl, what is your next project?
I'm starting to ponder them,
yeah.
But I like to hold things a little close to the chest at first, and otherwise the magic seems to escape.
Yeah, you got to hold on to that stuff, that's for sure. And of the 80 countries that you visited, is there anywhere you've not been that you want to go to?
Oh, wow, so many places. I mean, to me, the world, the more places I see, the bigger the world feels. You know, there's so many parts that I haven't seen. I've never been to, even though I spent a lot of time in Indonesia, for instance, I've never been to Laos, Vietnam, or Cambodia, which I'd love to go to. I would like to. I've never been to Argentina, which has always attracted me. I mean, so many places.
Oh, it's great. Just want to thank you for spending some time with us this morning. Your book is fascinating. And, you know, this is another great thing about books like yours. I knew very little about Borneo. I learned that it's, what, the third or fourth largest island. It straddles the Ecuador, or the equator, rather. It's about equidistant between Manila, Ho Chi Minh City, and Jakarta, I think might be sort of giving you the general area of where it is, if you don't know. But it's one of those parts in the world that, you know, we don't know a lot about.
Well, and it's a you're right, it's the third largest island in the world. And it's a fascinating place because it's so big and it's so rich, and it's an island that's kind of directly a stepping stone on the whole kind of outward migration of people, the Austronesians, beginning thousands of years ago from Taiwan, China, and, you know, all the way extending out into Polynesia. And so it was subject to wave after wave of you know, these great historical forces, both Buddhism and Hinduism, and then Muslims, and then Islam, and then waves of Chinese traders along the coasts, and these sultanates with the Dayaks inside, and then the Dayaks had relationships with the Penan, and then the Europeans, so the West came in. I mean, part of Sarawak was carved out and by James Brooke in the 1800s, and he became the White Raja of Sarawak. I mean, all these crazy stories and blending, thousands of years of blending of people.
Yeah. The book is titled The Last Wild Men of Borneo, A True Story of Death and Treasure. It's written by Carl Hoffman. Carl, there's tremendous buzz for this book, and we wish you continued success. And we also thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Okay. Oh, boy.
So, that's a great one.
Yeah.
And Savage Harvest as well was a huge success and really interesting. I knew nothing about Michael Rockefeller, the son of Nelson Rockefeller, disappearance. And great writer. Well, stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about the evolution of humankind. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are proud supporters of KPCW. We provide up-to-date market information, and our recent market report can be found at bhhsutah.com. Our agents can provide context to these market statistics and can be reached at 649-7171.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Carl Hoffman about The Last Wild Men of Borneo. Now we speak with Sang-hee Lee, who is, very interestingly, the first Korean paleoanthropologist, probably a story within itself. She teaches now at the University of California, Riverside, and she explores human evolution. She has written an international bestseller called Close Encounters with Humankind. A paleoanthropologist investigates our evolving species. She explores questions like, how about this one? Are we as humans cannibals? How did we become meat eaters? Why is childbirth so dangerous for mothers? Is altruism written in our DNA? And are we still evolving? Sang-hee Lee, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello.
Hi, great to have you. Well, first of all, you must start off with your story about being the first paleoanthropologist from Korea. How did you happen upon this line of work?
Oh, I get that question all the time, and I've been trying to come up with a more interesting story, but I'm so sorry. It's a very boring one. I was toward the end of my college years, and I started out as an archaeology major, and I was getting a little tired of digging and the dirt and the dust that I was working with. And I got this wonderful scholarship back in Korea where I was raised and went to college. I got this scholarship to come study in the United States for 5 years, no questions asked. It just had to be a basic science or humanities that field. So my advisor back then strongly suggested, well, if you don't like dirt and dust, maybe you could study bones that other people dug up in a nice, cool, air-conditioned museum, and then start a field that is much needed in our country. And I took his advice.
Wow. That is actually pretty fascinating.
Really?
It may sound boring to you, but it really is.
Oh.
It's funny how our lives' paths are often, the fork in the road could be something as simple as, oh, I really like clean hands.
Oh, well, you know what? That is actually one of the main points that I wanted to drive in this book, writing this book, or in my lectures, or generally even for life, how to live life, now that sometimes I get that question, is there's no right way, one way, and there's not even a design to get to where we are. You just make the best choice at the time and do your best and don't agonize over making the decisions.
Yeah.
Sang-hee, when I was younger, I was once called a Neanderthal, and it bothered me, of course.
But it's now, a compliment.
But now I'm complimented. I feel so good. And
yes.
I was so glad to read several chapters in your book about Neanderthals, Ich bin ein Neanderthal, the takeoff on John Kennedy's Berlin comment, that T-shirt.
Right,
and
yeah.
That they were very much like us. They did cave art. They adorned themselves with jewelry. They buried their dead with care. They may have developed language. Who knows? But
exactly.
Tell us about the Neanderthals and what you have discovered.
So the burial, especially, let me go back to the cave art. You know, there was this paper that came out most recently about how Neanderthals were the ones who started the act of cave art by them, the analysis of the pigment and dating that and associating that, the date of that pigment to the Neanderthal dating. It seems like a small piece of research or evidence, but it has a big impact on how we understand Neanderthals, and it breaks furthermore our stereotype of Neanderthals being somebody calling someone a Neanderthal not being a compliment, and that sort of image associated with a particular look and particular mental capacity and a particular set of behaviors, and that package is slowly being cracked open.
It certainly is, and I'm not going to go through all the detail, but in the 1990s there were people that felt from the Max Planck Institute that there was no connection. But then in 2010, they believe as the technology improved, that they were able to find 4% of our genes from Neanderthals, and they weren't useless genes. They were very important genes. So not only are we part of the Neanderthal, but they made a tremendous contribution to who we are today. Is that
That's
true?
Right. Yeah. That's right. The key to our success. The really takeaway, one of the takeaway lessons from that very interesting turn of events is that the same lab gave out those results. So first in the beginning of the 1990s, where they found no connection between the Neanderthal, back then mitochondrial DNA, and the modern humans, and followed by maybe 1 million base pairs of the nuclear genome, genes that had no connection with the modern humans. Then when they looked at the whole genome, from alpha to omega of our DNA, they did find connection. And what is very admirable and truly scientific about that research team led by Svante Paabo is that they came and confronted, accepted, and recognized the scientific value of what could be a sort of a contradictory to what their previous research showed, and came up and sort of with a chic way say, hey, I was wrong. This is the new data, and let's move forward with this. And I think this is very admirable. It's basically the fun of doing science, of course.
If I could just add one little piece to that, I believe that you mentioned in your book, by looking at their markings, you were able to determine that a 9-to-1 ratio similar to us, that they were right-handed, and that furthers the connection, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Our brain is asymmetrical, that is the difference between left side and the right side, and that is connected or associated with handedness. And whether Neanderthals had that kind of asymmetrical brain that would have some implications about their cognitive ability has been a big debate. And one very creative way to look at it was by the efforts from the team led by Dave Fair in Kansas back then, is to look at the right-handedness by looking at the markings on the teeth made by mistakes from scraping the stone tools, the blades, onto the teeth, which is actually cringes, makes me cringe.
Yes.
Just thinking about it. But, you know, if you make mistakes scraping your teeth, the surface of your front teeth with a stone tool, the angle of that scrape would be different whether you're a left-hander or a right-hander. So they analyzed the angles of those particular scars or scrapes of made and left on the surface of the teeth and showed that there is a 9-to-1 predominantly right-handedness in those angles. That's pretty ingenious.
That is very ingenious. And as lefties, both John and I, we're wondering if they did show much higher intellect among those very small percentage of left-handers, and was there any proof of that?
Oh, that's a very interesting hypothesis. I'll see if one of my graduate students would take it up as her.
I had heard their SAT scores were higher.
Oh.
300,000 years ago.
Corroborative evidence, of course.
Yeah. So tell us about the time span, how many thousands of years ago, you know, what's the time span of your book that you're looking at human evolution?
We're looking at the very beginning of hominins, which refer to all the humans and all of their ancestors up until the point where we, the human lineage, diverged from the most closely related lineage to us, which are the chimpanzee lineage. That's a textbook definition. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So that is the hominin, and the beginning of the hominin is as far back as I go, 4.4 million years, where we're talking about Ardipithecus.
Oh, and, you know, I just want to ask you to go through the diet, some of the things that you found about diet. You know, one of your questions is, you know, when we started eating meat and are we cannibals or were we or, you know.
Right.
How does it bleed into the present?
Yeah. Those are two, of course, very different questions. The fact that we became meat eaters is a very interesting one. It turns out that everybody loves meat. Even the herbivores love meat. Mm-hmm. And it's just that they cannot process and digest animal protein and fat to the level that we can. And in fact, our primates, other members of the primates, cannot digest that much of animal meat and fat either. It's just that humans are extraordinarily gifted in being able to digest that much food that has an animal protein and fat content. So but of course, because of the high quality and intensity of the caloric and nutritional content of those fat and protein, that allowed or enabled the growth and maintenance of this very expensive organ we call brain, as well as big body. So the question was, how did we, starting from very small brain, small-bodied animal ancestors of Australopithecus, for example, who are, you know, barely one-third the brain size and half our body size, body height, could they acquire that kind of high-caloric animal-based food, where hunting is something that they had to compete with the other kind of predators in the same ecosystem. So one way that they tried. I'm sure they tried many other ways, but one way that tried and succeeded, we think, is by being a hunter during the time when everybody else is not active. The other predators have to rest during the daytime, hot in the heat, because they cannot regulate their body heat the way we do. We use sweating mechanism, and that would allow us to be active during daytime when all the others are taking a siesta under the tree after their meal. Yeah. But in order to be active during daytime, we had to lose, by doing the sweating mechanism, had to lose fur, and that exposed us, our skin, to ultraviolet rays and made the melanin active skin be more adaptive in those environments. So losing fur, developing dark skin, and being able to acquire a lot of animal meat and fat, plus something that we hypothesize is the digestive ability to process that much high fat and protein without overloading your liver, for example. And all of that just sort of had to be in place in order to be the meat lovers that we are, for some of us at least.
Sanghee, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. I just want to mention to our listeners, if you're interested in learning about the difference between evolution, inheritance, the role of selection in evolution, all the different theories. This book answers all those questions. I have one quick question, and it might be unfair for a yes or no answer, but if 5 to 8 million years ago, if we evolved from apes, not monkeys, apes, and chimpanzees of ape family, this question, are there any apes that are starting to transition today towards humanness?
The apes are, okay, short answer, no. Apes themselves are a proud descendant of their own ancestors. We share ancestors, but we do not come from the current living apes. It's like if me and my cousin look like our grandparents, and my cousin looks more like my grandparents, that doesn't mean that I came from my cousin.
Right.
Yes.
But
that's a great way of putting it.
Yeah.
Well, Sanghee Lee is our guest, and her book is Close Encounters with Humankind, A Paleoanthropologist Investigates Our Evolving Species. And thank you so much, Sanghee, for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. This was very fun. Thank you.
Great. Take care. And Cool Science will be back in just a moment after these words.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we're happy to support KPCW. We are located at 352 Main Street and serve breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Rimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. Want to thank our underwriter, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services, Utah Properties, Nexus IT, Habitat for Humanity Restore, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain.
And we just want to make a quick mention. Stephen Hawking did pass away at his home on Wednesday in Cambridge, England. He was 76 years old. He roamed the cosmos from a wheelchair, pondering the nature of gravity and the origin of the universe, and really becoming an emblem of human determination and curiosity. And maybe on the next show we'll spend a little bit more time talking about his life. But
an incredible life, much longer, oodles longer, decades longer than was expected for him. What a man who contributed so much to our world.
Mm.
This is Travis Vernon, fly fishing coordinator of JANS and longtime supporter of KPCW. Our fly fishing department and guide service is open year-round and offers a full line of flies and product, including brands like Sims, Sage, and Fishpond. We also rent rods, reels, and waders. Available at the flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or JANS.com.
It's KPCW Park City. Time now for national news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Trump administration is imposing new sanctions on Russia. NPR's Ryan Lucas says the punitive measures are over Moscow's interference in the 2016 election and malicious cyber attacks.
The new sanctions target 19 Russians and five entities, including two of Russia's most powerful intelligence services. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says the U.S. is, quote, confronting and countering malign Russian cyber activity. He lists Russia's interference in American elections and destructive cyber attacks, as well as intrusions targeting critical infrastructure. Many of the individuals hit with sanctions today were indicted last month by special counsel Robert Mueller over their alleged role in Russia's influence operation during the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. Mnuchin says the administration plans to impose more sanctions to hold Russian government officials and oligarchs accountable by cutting them off from the U.S. financial system. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The administration's announcing sanctions shortly after the White House released a statement declaring that the U.S. is joining France, Germany, and the United Kingdom in saying it's highly likely Russia was responsible for the March 4th nerve agent attack on a Russian former spy and his daughter in England. While the U.K. dramatically denounced Russia, President Trump's remarks had been more tepid. Today, though, he publicly sided with British Prime Minister Theresa May's assessment.
I spoke with the Prime Minister, and we are in deep discussions, a very sad situation. It certainly looks like the Russians were behind it, something that should never, ever happen. And we're taking it very seriously, as I think are many others.
Trump addressed reporters a short time ago during a joint White House appearance with the Prime Minister of Ireland. The Associated Press is reporting that a Lebanese-American businessman who is cooperating in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation is a convicted child sex offender. According to the AP, George Nader served a year behind bars in 2003 in the Czech Republic for molesting minors. The nation's largest radio broadcaster, iHeartMedia, has filed for bankruptcy to mitigate debt of more than $20 billion. NPR's David Folkenflik reports the deal would cut that debt by about half.
iHeart owns and operates 850 commercial radio stations around the country. It missed an interest payment of $100 million last month as it tried to work out an arrangement with creditors. Now, iHeart and many of its subsidiaries have filed for Chapter 11. It owes that money to investors such as Bain Capital and Thomas H. Lee Partners, who were involved in a leveraged buyout in 2008. John Malone's Liberty Media also bought a $400 million stake in iHeart debt a few weeks ago. He's been seeking to combine iHeart with satellite radio company SiriusXM, which Liberty already owns. The bankruptcy does not include the company's Clear Channel outdoor billboard division. iHeart says it has restructured half of its debt. The bankruptcy is giving it time to work out a deal on the rest with its bondholders. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
This is NPR. Federal investigators are looking into the cause of a fatal bus crash in Alabama. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports the bus driver was killed. At least nine passengers remain in the hospital after the charter bus careened off an interstate bridge.
The charter bus was taking high school students from Orlando back home to Texas when it crashed into a ravine off I-10 near the Alabama-Florida line just before dawn on Tuesday. Pete Katowski with the National Transportation Safety Board says a team of investigators is on scene to collect evidence. He says the motor coach was new on its second run and was equipped with seat belts. Alabama State Trooper say the 65-year-old driver's autopsy results may provide clues about why the bus veered across a median into oncoming traffic before driving off a steep embankment. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The man convicted of manslaughter in a road rage shooting in 2016 that killed former NFL running back Joe McKnight reportedly has been sentenced to 30 years in prison. The Associated Press reports Ronald Gasser was facing up to 40 years. March Madness begins in earnest this hour. NPR's Tom Goldman says action starts in the main bracket of the men's Division I college tournament with 16 games.
Some of the country's top teams play today, including Kansas, Villanova, and Duke. The appeal of this tournament also means teams like Radford, Iona, and Penn get their moment in the spotlight, probably not for long. USA Today says the money of March Madness includes $10 billion bet on the tournament, $2.3 billion in lost workplace productivity, and $0 $1,000 paid to the players.
That's NPR's Tom Goldman. The Dow is up 244. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, committed to protecting cars and drivers, whether on the open road or having a driveway moment while listening to NPR. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And Americans for the Arts at americansforthearts.org.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, E-S-C-O.
Support for KPCW comes from Live at the Eccles, presenting Lyle Lovett and His Large Band, September 6th at Eccles Theater, downtown Salt Lake. The singer, composer. Support for KPCW comes from Done to Your Taste Catering and Events, offering cuisine for groups from 20 to 2,000 for corporate pop-up receptions, destination weddings, home soirees, and more. They can be reached at 435-649-7503 or their Main Street tasting room. Done to Your Taste, serving Park City for 29 years. DTYTEvents.com.
Hey, Mom, you know how you're always trying to plan ahead?
Yes, what did I forget?
Nothing yet. You have until April 6th to sign up for Running with Ed.
Can you always be in charge of my schedule, Skye? That's right. Running with Ed is the race that's a party. No age limit, no excuses. And all the money raised goes to the Park City Education Foundation, our kids' education. Race day is May 19th. Register now at runningwithed.com. Running with Ed is a project of PCEF, a nonprofit, and a KPCW supporter.
Good morning. You are listening to nonprofit, listener-supported KPCW. I'm Craig Cooper with you until 12 o'clock today. It's currently 8 minutes past the hour of 10 on a lightly snowing day. We've got 80% chance of snow throughout today with a high of 40 degrees. Tonight, 80% chance of snow showers continues through the night with a low of 20 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny skies.